Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk. And this is also our final pre-Iowa podcast. We won't be putting out our usual Monday evening show. We're instead going to record a late night podcast once we have the results from the Iowa caucuses. Now, at this point, around noon on Sunday, February 2nd, the race is very close. We're still waiting on a couple polls, but according to our forecast, this is what things look like. Bernie Sanders has a 38% chance of winning the most votes, essentially tied with the second most likely winner, Joe Biden, who has a 36% chance of winning the most votes. Buttigieg is next with a 13% chance, then Warren at 10%, and then Klobuchar at 3%. So, Nate, how would you characterize the state of the race in Iowa with one day to go?
I would characterize it as being pretty uncertain, and there's kind of a rank order of who has the most to be happy about considering that uncertainty. You know, Sanders, there are still more polls coming out. I think Sanders will be slightly ahead once we finish inputting all this data and polls that are embargoed, but I know are coming out later, right? I think Sanders will be slightly ahead, but not that far ahead. There are plenty of polls that show Joe Biden either ahead or tied. Almost all the polls still show Mayor Pete in a competitive position. Many of them show Elizabeth Warren in a competitive position. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Is this a uniquely unpredictable Iowa caucus?
I mean, there are some factors, right? Whenever you have four or five candidates, that increases unpredictability. Four to five, I should say, candidates that are salient in either being a contender or at least kind of having enough of a vote where their vote goes, if they don't hit these thresholds that we'll talk about, could be relevant. I think number two, it's just been a weird caucus as far as the timing with respect to impeachment and to some extent other news, where you haven't had the climactic buildup to the Iowa caucus that certainly of the races I've covered that you've had, you know, and looking at things like search volume for different candidates, there's not that big of a spike like you might sometimes get. Maybe that'll happen in the last 24 hours as we tape this, but it feels like it's kind of like a bit of a aborted kind of process. I don't know who that benefits.
But in terms of the tightness of Biden and Sanders at this point, is it common that we're heading into caucus day where the front runners are basically neck and neck?
No, it's not unusual. I mean, what's unusual is to have also third and fourth place candidates that are pretty close and a fifth place candidate who maybe or maybe not is somewhat viable.
What are the biggest unknowns at this point in terms of how things actually shake out Monday night?
I think the biggest unknown, I mean, there are many unknowns, right? One big unknown concerns, we don't actually really have much polling for the past few days. There are polls that are going to be released, not including the Des Moines Register poll. Apparently, we could talk about that later, maybe.
Yeah.
There are polls that are being released Sunday this afternoon as we're speaking, but some of them were conducted actually several days ago. So one basic unknown is like there's a lot of news now, how voters might react to impeachment, how they might react to the closing pitches of the candidate. We don't really know any of that yet. Secondly, you have a lot of candidates who are hovering near 15%. And in Iowa, you go to your precinct to caucus, and your candidate has to be at least 15% to be what's called viable, which means viable means you're eligible for getting delegates to the state convention, which is kind of the quasi-official way, although there are actually several quasi-official ways that Iowa measures who wins. So long and short of it is that if you're Warren, let's say you're 16% statewide, well, probably in some precincts that are college educated, for example, you're comfortably over 15%, but some you're not. And where your voters go is pretty relevant in that scenario. In general, that process tends to help the front runners to pull ahead a little bit further. But there are all sorts of theories about if Klobuchar is at 8 or 9%, then she won't get over 15% in very many places. Then that might be good for Biden, potentially. Mm-hmm. Whereas if Warren slips a little bit, that could be good for Bernie. In general, Warren and Buttigieg both pick up a fairly decent amount of second choice support. So that's another fairly big unknown. By the way, the campaigns can strike deals. They can say, okay, Mayor Pete and Elizabeth, not necessarily the best of friends on the campaign trail, but strategically they could say, okay, well, we don't want Bernie and Biden to pull way ahead and finish 1-2 and shut out the rest of us, right? So therefore, let's do some horse trading. I, as Elizabeth Warren, will try to get my people to go to Buttigieg or maybe Klobuchar. And then you talk to Buttigieg and Klobuchar, they're like, okay, we'll do the same thing, right? We don't want to help out the front runners, Biden and Bernie.
So do we know of any of those deals specifically at this
point?
No,
and I think if you're doing it properly, then you wouldn't know until caucus night or afterward or never, right? There was some overture that the Biden campaign made to Klobuchar, and I think the Klobuchar folks, I don't know who leaked it for what purpose, right? But like that apparently was rejected, which kind of makes sense. I mean, Klobuchar needs Biden to do poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs Biden and Bernie to do poorly, or it could become a two-candidate race. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to make a deal with Biden and Bernie. They could deal with one another. That'd be funny.
Unlikely. So anyway, still some significant unknowns as we get down to actual caucus day. Of course, another one is turnout, right? I mean, we've gotten several messages asking, you know, how does the model account for turnout? And I think the answer is it doesn't specifically account for turnout.
It's not our job to predict turnout. We're relying on pollsters to predict turnout. And clearly, you know, there are pretty systematic differences in the polls that are not explained by chance alone, right? Clearly, some pollsters have a different philosophy over who's going to turn out than others.
What are some of those different philosophies?
One philosophy is to say anyone who says they're going to turn out, you assume they'll turn out. I mean, it's the two basic types of likely voter models, right? One just takes people's views at face value. The other tries to apply some screens based on which elections you voted in the past.
And how does that affect ultimately how the candidates do?
The ones that take it at face value tend to be good for Bernie, and the ones that require some vote history or put some criteria on it tend to be better for Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And there are good pollsters in both these camps. I personally tend to be more of a take voters at their word kind of guy, just kind of philosophically, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I don't like the idea of a pollster saying, okay, you told me you're going to vote and you're registered to vote, but I don't think you're going to vote. I don't like that philosophically. But, you know, empirically, you probably want a blend of the two, which is the whole point of taking a polling average. And in general, by the way, these online polls tend to be good for the candidate to draw kind of younger, often college-educated voters, meaning everyone but Biden, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a question, are they missing, like, working-class older voters, potentially? Conversely, some polls might have trouble getting enough young voters with the new demographic weighting to try to compensate for that. But yeah, so there's a lot of ambiguity, I would say.
All right, so you referenced this a little bit earlier, but we were expecting a final poll from the Des Moines Register this weekend on Saturday. The release of that poll was canceled. What do we know about what happened?
It's all about cancel culture.
The poll got hashtag canceled.
Okay, so started hearing funny rumors at about 7 p.m. last night that the Buttigieg folks were unhappy with the poll because they had heard from a supporter who was not read Buttigieg among the list of options that he was given. So they were making hay about this. Someone contacted the Des Moines Register, and they confirmed that there was some sort of a problem. What happened is that a surveyor is probably someone young, probably making not much more than minimum wage. Okay, so we should have some sympathy here. That person is reading a screen from which they read the questions, and that screen lists all the candidates, which are randomized in order. This interviewer had enlarged the font on her screen so that the bottom name was cut off. So in one call, it was Buttigieg, and one call, it might be Tom Steyer or something. And every time she was using that screen, then you would miss a candidate in the poll.
But if it's randomized, right, you would expect
That's right.
the candidate who's missed to also be randomized.
Well, there are two things, right? Number one, if it is randomized, which it sounds like it was, then it's not going to systematically affect any candidate. It's not ideal, but it's not going to systematically affect one candidate more than the others. Number two is, like, they should know exactly which screen and interviewer were used to conduct which interviews, right? So let's say, okay, just as out of an abundance of caution, instead of throwing the whole poll out, let's eliminate any interview conducted on this monitor or by this interviewer. If you absolutely have to, you can go and say, we're going to delay the poll by a day and conduct more interviews to replace these, right? But they did not. They, what I would describe as panicked instead.
So you think that canceling the release of the Des Moines Register poll was an overreaction?
I think that, yes. I think canceling it that night was an over. I mean, I don't know. There could have been other things. Sometimes you're, you know, if we have an article or a data set that we're publishing, sometimes you'll detect one thing wrong with it, and you're like, okay, this seems pretty minor and fixable. And in the process of discovering that one thing, you'll discover a second problem, right, that seems like it might be more serious. And you're like, okay, we're not going to publish this, right? But, like, look, they were under a lot of pressure from, number one, CNN, which irresponsibly, in my view, had a whole TV show, literally like an hour's worth of TV, where they're going to reveal this poll. I mean, that's really, I think, a bad idea for lots of reasons. One of which is that you don't want to put any one poll on a pedestal as having the importance of actual results, right? I mean, there are, in the last week here, 10 or so roughly different polling firms that have released results in Iowa. Some are better than others, and Seltzer is better than almost anyone, but, like, still, we look at this mathematically, like, you might give Seltzer, empirically, you might give it double the weight of an average pollster. You don't give it 10 times the weight, right? You don't ignore every other poll out there, and all these polls are making different choices that are debatable. And also, you have a print deadline in the Des Moines Register, too. It's their big kind of Sunday headline. So they were not affording themselves a lot of flexibility. You know, I don't know. I don't know how much the people making these decisions know the ins and outs of polling necessarily. I think people in general are paranoid about kind of trying to blame the polls or throw the polls under the bus or whatever else, right? I think people, frankly, like, I don't stand their ground enough, and you're going to, okay, so what? Some mayor people complain? Okay, well, no shit. You know, if you're in public life covering politics as a pollster or a journalist or a data journalist or whatever else, right, some people are going to be unhappy sometimes, and most of the time the answer to them is, like, we're doing the best we can. We're going to explain ourselves as best as we can, and, like, and sometimes you're going to be unhappy. That's, you know, that's life. I think it was a decision that if they had more time to think about it, they might have come around to a different conclusion.
Right. In terms of that story that you laid out, how exactly a candidate's name was cut off from the survey, have we confirmed that and that there was nothing else going on in terms of anybody purposefully excluding a candidate's name or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think any of this was alleged to be purposeful. But the thing is, mm-hmm. like, if you're going to have a survey that has 500 or 600, I'm not sure how many interviews they would have had, 700. If you're going to have that and you're relying on underpaid labor and or college students, I did this in high school, by the way. It was a high school summer job before I ever had any interest in, like, getting into, like, what I do now, right? I actually was kind of, like, worked for Michigan State University in their polling lab for a few summers. it's not a terribly glamorous or fun job. You're there, you're on the phone all day, you're getting a lot of wrong numbers, you're getting a lot of people who are rude to you, you are reading often these very kind of complicated questions that you have to read verbatim, right? You're dealing with people who give ambiguous responses. I'm sure at every survey of 500 people that one of these interviewers at some point out of 500 interviews skips over a name, misenters a name, coaxes a response out of someone, not in a biased way, but because they're impatient, right? You know, well, who would you say or whatever, right? Someone gives an ambiguous response, they code it some way that's debatable or not, right? They don't follow the protocols. In some polls, you're supposed to ask for a particular person in the household, right? Who's the person with the next birthday? Can I speak to them? I'm sure that's not always followed to the letter of the law. And so part of it is, like, this kind of false notion, which happens anytime you're dealing with any types of numbers. People are, like, not accounting for, it's not uncertainty exactly, but, like, you know, robust systems.
Human error.
Yeah. Robust systems tolerate human error. And so the fact that, for example, they rotate the name of the candidates, which any pollster should do anyway, because there's, like, a slight bias toward candidates that you might hear first or last, right? But, like, that is something that made it less consequential if you're skipping a name. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, a good pollster would also have a procedure for if someone were like, well, what about someone else, right? What about Mayor Pete? Then they would have a procedure for how that would be handled and maybe realize it. You know what I mean?
So essentially, the takeaway here is that from the information we have, this seemed like something that was resolvable in a way other than canceling the poll.
Yes.
Do you think what happened here, either the news that came out about the human error involved or not releasing the poll in general, does damage to people's trust in polls overall?
Well, I don't know. I think it might do more damage to polling's reputation because your big headline, like, oh, there was a glitch with the poll, whereas it's actually any single poll could have had something like this happen, that someone is nearsighted and they turn up the font on their screen, right, and miss a name. I mean, like, that could literally happen to any poll that uses live interviewers, which are still the overall the most accurate polls. And so I think CNN and DMR did not do a service to the polling industry. There are big consequences to not publishing this poll that undermine trust in polling, and, like, I think we would have made a different decision at 538, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe not. But, like, if that was all that was wrong with it, then that's not what I would have done.
Is the outcome of the Iowa caucuses more uncertain because this poll wasn't released? Is it that good or that important of a poll that we're a little more in the dark?
I mean, it's no such thing as, like no poll is magic. You know what I mean? You know, I think it contributes to a general sense of, like, voters might not feel like they have a lot of information or guidance where they don't have this poll. It's probably the fifth most important reason, right? The more important reasons being, like, the candidates have been on the campaign trail. The media's been focused on impeachment and even, like, coronavirus and stuff like that. It's been a while since we had the last debate. There have been a lot of news cycles since then. It wasn't a debate around the eve of Iowa like you sometimes might get, or like we'll get New Hampshire, for example. And so, like, so you can imagine, like, voters feeling a little bit in the dark. You know, I do wonder if that, like, yields a lower turnout.
Does this poll in particular have an effect on results? Like, people see the leader of the Des Moines Register?
Well, there are different ways you can argue it, right? I mean, on the one hand, you might want to behave tactically. So you see a candidate rising, and now you're like, oh, let's say Amy Klobuchar had done really well in this poll, which I don't know would have been the case, but let's say that she would have. Like, that would have helped her, because then people would be like, oh, Klobuchar can win, therefore I'm going to vote for her, even if she's my first choice, and not worry about defaulting to Pete or Biden or something. But there's a flip side, too. I mean, I think there are probably some voters in Iowa who want to actually keep the race wide open and might think, oh, well, Biden doesn't need my vote since he's doing well in this poll, so I'm free to vote for Klobuchar, right? Or campaigns might get together and they say, okay, well, actually, now that Bernie and Biden are way ahead, let's kind of align with one another and work together to make sure they don't get too far out in front. And by the way, and the so-called expectations game, let's say, hypothetically, purely hypothetically.
Okay.
Purely hypothetically, Galen. The last DMR poll that was published had Biden in fourth place. Let's say purely hypothetically that this poll had also had Biden in fourth place. And that had gotten a lot of attention. Maybe not hypothetically a particularly great fourth place, a fourth placey fourth place instead. If that was the case, then all of a sudden Biden finishing second would look like a miracle, right? Even though there are lots of other polls that use different methodologies that have him in first or second. So if you're given, like, a lot of salience to this poll, that might have lowered expectations.
Essentially, the poll can have an effect on voters' perception and behavior, but it's not clear exactly what effect it has, and it can be multifaceted.
But it also has effects on the media interpretation of the race, right? Like, if you had had... Yeah. I think the perception, for better or worse, is still sort of like, oh, it's Bernie's race to lose, right? But if you had had, like, a... Let's say the poll had shown him, like, surging to 28%, then expectations would be very high for him, and all of a sudden, if he did anything other than finish first, it would be seen as, oh, Bernie blew it at the last minute. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I want to broaden this out a little bit and ask a couple listener questions. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Calm. They say it takes 2 months to form a habit, and if you're making a resolution this year, that can feel like a long time to wait to see results. With Calm, all it takes is 5 minutes a day to feel better, calmer, and ready to face whatever this year throws at you. Calm is the number one app for sleep, relaxation, and meditation. Calm has sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. They can help you fall into a deep, natural sleep in minutes. They also have soothing music from artists like Sam Smith, guided meditations, breathing exercises, and so much more to help you relax and de-stress. And if you go to calm.com/538, you'll get a limited time offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programming. Over 60 million people use Calm. Join them today to accomplish your goals tomorrow. Again, for listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/538. Get started today at calm.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Getting into debt is easy, but getting out is hard, especially if your credit score isn't great. Thankfully, there's Upstart.com, the revolutionary lending platform that knows you're more than just your credit score and offers smarter interest rates to help pay off high interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. The best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. Free yourself from the burden of high interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics. All right, we're back, and we got several questions about undecided voters at this point. Are there still a large number of undecideds in Iowa?
So there are not necessarily that many like people who formally are undecided, right, who refuse to give a choice to the pollster even after being prompted. There are a lot of people, though, who say, I could still change my mind. And because of the nature of the caucus process, where, look, there is no candidate who's guaranteed in your particular precinct to get above 15%. You know, Bernie will statewide almost for sure, and, you know, but in your certain precinct, maybe just doesn't happen to have a lot of Bernie voters there. So you always have to be thinking about multiple choices in Iowa. So things are a bit unsettled. Hypothetically, if someone had created some huge news on today, that would still, on Sunday, that would still have a big effect. I don't know that anyone does. Like, it's not clear to me, like, who really has momentum, quote unquote. You know, Bernie has some medium-term momentum here over the course of the past few weeks, right? I'm not sure if he has short-term momentum particularly. People thought Klobuchar had momentum. The polls that came out Sunday, today, were not particularly good for her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not clear.
We got a question from Catherine asking if the fact that four of the Democratic candidates weren't able to campaign in Iowa in person because of the impeachment trial had any effect on the race there.
I think it's probably pretty minor. I mean, if they had been prohibited from the whole race from campaigning in Iowa, that might be a bigger deal, right? But they have plenty of rallies earlier. They have surrogates there. When they do make their appearance, they have big turnouts. It's kind of a big deal that they're coming back, right? They can do national TV appearances and televised town halls in the meantime. I think this is probably a pretty minor effect.
And it's worth saying, actually, as we're recording this right now, I just got an email back from Ann Selzer, who conducts the Des Moines Register poll. I asked if she would be able to join us briefly for this podcast today, and unfortunately not today, but she said maybe at some point. So
interesting.
We will see. Maybe at some point in the future we'll have her on and be able to talk about what exactly happened and what its effect is on polling in general.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think a lot of this is under deadline pressure. You have to make decisions. And, I mean, how can I put this in a way that doesn't... I think CNN might have more concern about kind of reader trust issues than the Des Moines Register, which is a relatively beloved local paper, still might, right? So they might have said, oh, we trust people to kind of assume that we're being honest and that we found out this one interviewer was using too large a font. We threw out her 40 interviews. Now we have a poll of 460 people instead of 500 and actually didn't change the results that much, right? But I don't know. CNN had this show at 9 and I don't know what the conversations were like there. I would love to have been a fly on the wall.
Me too.
But that was bad karma, CNN. Don't do that.
Okay, so some more questions from listeners. This is a pretty wonky one, but Nick wants to know if 10,000 simulations, which is how many simulations there are each time we run the forecast model, whether 10,000 is enough.
It's not as many as we run for some of our other products. For some other products, we run, say, 50,000 simulations. The problem is the program is actually like pretty computationally intensive. The 10,000 simulations running on multiple servers takes around 35 or 40 minutes. And so we have to just kind of pick a trade-off where, like, are we willing to wait an hour and a half every time the model's updated to have 20,000 simulations instead of 10,000? We know that good trade-off is worth it, right? And so therefore, but people should be aware, like one thing I think we've tried to do in like the write-ups of this model, you know, if someone goes from like 26% to 27%, we're not like, oh my God, you know, oh my God, now they're at 27%. I think we're being pretty judicious about like waiting for shifts of several percentage points to kind of declare a change in the race. And that's because like with 10K versus 50K, you actually do run into some sample size issues.
Mm-hmm. We actually got a question from a state representative in Pennsylvania. Malcolm Kenyatta asks, what will the impact of the State of the Union and impeachment vote right after the Iowa caucuses have on media coverage?
Well, I mean, it would seem to dampen media coverage quite a bit is the obvious response.
So is that bad for whoever comes in first?
Yeah, Gilly, we worked together long enough where you probably know how I feel about the State of the Union.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I do.
Most useless political and boring political ritual. It's like anti-Nate, the State of the Union. It's like all things I don't like about politics. It's all pomp and circumstance, no suspense, no substance, right? It's everything I dislike about politics.
However, the conventional media, the mainstream media, whatever you want to call
it, a big deal, right?
Does treat it as a big deal.
And they will certainly treat, I mean, the amount of coverage to impeachment, I'm going to say it. It's on the podcast. On the podcast, you know, I don't get in quite as much trouble as when I say things on Twitter, right? I think the media has undercovered Iowa relative to impeachment. Obviously, impeachment deserves a lot of coverage, right? I think the balance has not quite been right because the Democratic nominee is very important to the future of this country. And we're going to know a lot more about who that nominee is likely to be after Monday. And impeachment is like something where the result's been fairly baked in.
But more as a question of how this ultimately affects
okay,
the balance.
Okay, I know. I just want to go to want to go to rant.
Okay, yeah. Rant accomplished.
So
how does this affect any potential bounce?
Well, like, let's say that the bounce would be half as large as it would ordinarily, because it is a lot largely about media coverage, especially for Iowa and New Hampshire. For Super Tuesday, that's a third of the delegates, right? So if Biden has a really good Super Tuesday, then like that really tangibly affects the math. With Iowa, it's all about the media coverage because it's 1% of delegates or whatever it is. Therefore, if you have only half as much media coverage, which might not be a bad estimation, then maybe that means you only get half as large a bounce. And if that's the case, then that's probably really good news for Biden. Like if you in our model say, okay, we're going to remove, you know, tune down the bounce parameter from what it has been empirically to half as much, we're not doing that, but if we had, right, that would help Biden quite a bit. It would hurt any chance that like Pete Buttigieg or Warren have of coming back. It would not be great for Sanders, but might be okay because he's in the second strongest position with or without a bounce probably. Yeah.
Next question comes from Brock, which maybe this isn't really answerable, particularly by our model, but who is most likely a surprise candidate who receives a fair portion more than forecasted? So let's frame it this way, Nate. If on Tuesday morning I said one candidate really did a lot better than we expected, like, what a surprise, who would you guess that candidate was?
I mean, there are arguments for different people, right? You can look at the ground game, which I think by most reporting I've seen would rank it as follows. Buttigieg and Warren kind of tied for 1A, Bernie kind of 1B, and then a big gap, and Biden quite a bit behind them.
And Klobuchar, presumably, as well, after that big gap.
I haven't seen much about it. Although she's, you know, she's gotten like a lot of endorsements like Iowa State Representative. Maybe she's ahead of Biden. I don't know, but probably not. She's had like less money. That's one reason that would call for Warren or Peter or Bernie to overperform. They're different things, though, right? The second choices are very important. It depends on the exact math of who is falling short and which scenario, and kind of everyone has an upside case there, right? You know, Warren and Buttigieg in general have high favorability ratings, can be a consideration for many different types of voters. On the other hand, there are clearer conduits you can see for the other candidates. You can see Warren supporters going to Bernie. You can see Klobuchar supporters going to Biden. You can see Yang supporters going to Bernie, maybe. Steyer supporters, I don't know where they would roll up, frankly, but probably not to Bernie, probably to someone else, maybe to Warren. That's another uncertainty, I would say. I tend to think that when you look at polls with second choices, they actually, then Warren tends to benefit from that as to some extent as Buttigieg, and so it becomes a closer race that way. The third thing is that, it's getting in the weeds, although this is the right show for it, The way that Iowa traditionally counts its vote is by something called state delegate equivalence. And what that means is that there are basically a fixed number of delegates available in every precinct, depending on how large your precinct is. So if you have a big surge in turnout, you get a whole group of people to turn out for Bernie, for example, then it might disadvantage candidates whose support is concentrated in certain areas and or who are relying on a lot of new support and or who are in parts of the state that are growing. And so that could actually give an edge to the candidates who seem to be better statewide in the more rural areas, which seems to be maybe Buttigieg, actually, maybe Klobuchar, probably not Warren, whose support is very concentrated in the suburbs. Maybe not Bernie, who sometimes gets good rural support, but also clearly is relying on a big surge of turnout, right? A big Bernie surge of turnout that's concentrated in certain precincts would not be as helpful to Bernie as a statewide surge. And that seems like a scenario where Bernie could, like, rack up. I mean, again, I think it's kind of all silly. You know what I mean? And Iowa will report, actually, what the original popular vote is. And I see people online, they're like, well, Bernie's going to spin the popular vote being... It's like, well, sure. What's wrong with spinning the popular vote being the best metric? Because that's what 44 states use, right? There are four states that use ranked choice. There are two states, Iowa and Nevada, use some version of this process, right? The other 44, just a popular vote. So to the extent that Iowa is indicative of future results, then that's a perfectly valid set of spin, I think.
I've actually heard that if they had released the popular vote numbers in 2016, it would have showed that Bernie Sanders won in Iowa.
Yeah, that's, I think, commonly believed. I don't think anyone's actually, I mean, they didn't record that information. There's no way to know for sure, but clearly the places where Bernie did better were places where you had fewer delegates per voter. And given how close it was, it seems like a reasonable inference.
So wrapping up here, I just want to zoom out slightly because we did get some questions based on our overall model, not our Iowa model. And just to cite what we're showing, Biden has a 45% chance of winning the majority of delegates. Sanders has a 29% chance, 16% chance that nobody gets a majority, 6% for Warren, 4% Buttigieg, and 1% chance for all the other candidates combined. Now, we had some listeners, readers, notice that in our national polling average, Bloomberg is now ahead of Buttigieg. And there were some questions about whether, you know, the overall model, which still had Buttigieg's odds significantly higher than Bloomberg's, was underestimating Bloomberg in some sense because he is now polling better nationally.
Well, I designed the model, and I don't think it's necessarily underestimating Bloomberg. I mean, it does have him getting, like, decent numbers of delegates. It has him, like, getting, like, 100-some delegates in average simulation. But the problem is, like, a path to an actual majority is pretty hard, where you're getting a... So first of all, maybe he's bobbing around 10 to 12% in some of the Super Tuesday states. Maybe he'll get above 15% in some states and districts, right? It's not actually that good. That actually gets you some delegates, doesn't get you that many. Second of all, like, you're going to have some big story coming out of the first four states, right? Unless it's, you know, a certain exact scenario, then those probably won't be good stories for Bloomberg because he'll be overshadowed by people who are surging or gaining or resilient or whatever else. So it's like, okay, so you got 10% of the vote in some states. You may lose momentum between then and now, right? Even if you kind of do, like, reasonably well, then now you've already had 36% of the delegates or something assigned, and you're trying to get a majority of the remaining 62% from the remaining 62% when you have very few delegates so far, right? That's quite far-fetched, actually. And by the way, you're hoping to win in a contested convention? Like, okay, maybe. We don't try to forecast that. But, like, I don't know. You're not, you know, you haven't been a Democrat that long, right? You're not exactly a compromise candidate. By the way, people are only seeing these Bloomberg commercials. There's not really any negative campaigning against Bloomberg, but he has a lot of vulnerabilities ranging from his wealth to his age to stop and frisk to not having been a lifelong Democrat and having some endorsed some people that Democrats really wouldn't like very much. The allegation that he's trying to buy the election, I'm sure, you know, would play into Bernie or Warren's hands potentially. And so for me, I don't know. I think people are in a bubble, dude. And like, we can debate whether Bloomberg chances are 1% or 5% or 8% or something, right? They're not high. Because, like, it's kind of like a basketball team that says, well, we have a great strategy, but it involves not playing the first quarter. You know, the first quarter, we're not going to take the court. The other team will score some points, And once we've seen how they work, we'll step in, right? And like, okay, like physically that won't work. You're not going to win that game. You know what I mean? Like there are physical rules to how the primary nomination process works. And I think there are people who are idiotic and don't do the diligence on like what those rules actually are. Not competing in the first four states and then kind of getting in afterward, right? I mean, the thing about the first four states is, yeah, if Bloomberg got some symbolic third place victory in New Hampshire or something, right, then you build your momentum, you get your bounce, and then there's a payoff because then you have 33% of the states, of the delegates, are available on Super Tuesday. If you're using Super Tuesday as your launching pad, you've burned a lot of the rope that you have to gain delegates later on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess now is a good time to remind people that the significance of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina is entirely their positioning in the sequential primary, right? There are 41 delegates up for the taking on Monday. 41 out of almost 4,000 pledged delegates in the process. So while mathematically you would think, oh, if you just skip the first four states, you're still fine. You can still, you know, get a majority of the delegates. The reality of how our system works is not so.
Yeah, I mean, it's 1% of the delegates, right? So it doesn't really matter. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe this won't be a great cycle in the long term for Iowa. I don't know. It's felt weird.
I mean, there's been a decent amount of backlash from even people participating in the primary against Iowa and its first position. But anyway, let's wrap things up and give listeners a sense of how Monday night is going to look on the 538 website. We're going to start live blogging at 6 p.m. and people should stick with us all night. We're going to be live blogging as the results come in, and then we're going to have a reaction podcast later in the evening once we have those results, hopefully, unless, you know, it's too close to call and we're up until 3. But either way, we will have a reaction podcast for listeners sometime Monday night, Tuesday morning, something like that. That's it. This is our last pre-Iowa podcast. We're done.
Yeah. Happy Iowa-ing, people.
Happy Iowa-ing. Yeah. Send us your caucusers. Send us your pictures. Tell us what those high school gymnasiums are like.
Tell us your stories, yeah. Yeah, we want to know. We want the scoop. If you feel like, you know, you got like an eager beaver Buttigieg volunteer who's like, oh, well, you know, maybe you should support Elizabeth Warren or vice versa. We'd love to know the machinations and deals that are taking place, right? We'd love to know that.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, Nate.
All right. Thanks, Caitlin.
And a couple things to mention before we go. We have a few tickets left to our Manchester, New Hampshire live show on Sunday, February 9th. So head over to 538.com/live for tickets. I also wanted to give a shout out to one of my favorite podcasts, On the Media. We've collaborated with them in the past, and actually next week, they're going to be featuring the Primaries Project on their show, along with a deep dive into the role that New Hampshire plays in the primary process. So be sure to check that out next week. You can listen to On the Media wherever you get your podcasts, or go to onthemedia.org. My name is Galen Druk. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.